Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/westwoodone.
On my first day of law school, my professor says two things. First, from this day forward, when your mother says she loves you, get a second opinion.
And?
If you want justice, go to a whorehouse. You want to get fucked, go to court.
In a world where zombies, ghosts, serial killers, and vampires all exist, it's Nico, Brian, Mike, and Dustin. And they are all that stand between you and the films that could end the world. Welcome to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast. Just want to thank all of our fans and listeners. Really appreciate the support. You guys are awesome. Before we get into tonight's film review, just want to give a quick shout out to our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Everything about our podcast is on the website. All of our episodes and interviews, if you want to check those out. We've done some incredible interviews in the past. Go check them out there in a specific tab by themselves so you don't have to scroll through hundreds of episodes on Apple or Spotify, etc. We also have our store if you want to grab a shirt, a mouse pad, a hat, all that good stuff. We'd love to see your pictures, you know, rep your favorite podcast. And Chan's Etsy page is also attached if you want to grab a Tumblr. All of our social media links are on there as well. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. Like us, subscribe us, follow us, all that good stuff. And the last thing I want to shout out on our website is our Patreon. We call it Blood Donors. We have the traditional monthly reoccurring kind. If you want to support us, help us pay the bills, as we say, or if there's a movie you want us to review, that option is available as well. Just check out our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Also, if you haven't noticed, we've recently joined the Believe Network, so there's some ads on our program now. But if you want ad-free content, go check us out on Blood Donors. The ad-free episodes will be available there. We appreciate your support. We hope you enjoy the episode.
All right, guys, jumping to the film review. We're going to be reviewing a Blood Donor. Shout out to Anita Russell, Final Girl Donor, two-time Final Girl Donor. We really appreciate the donation. We're going to be reviewing her choice of Primal Fear, Richard Gere, Laura Linney, one of Dustin's favorites. His name is slipping my Ed Norton. There we go. Boom, pulled it right off the back of my... It slipped my mind, brother. But anywho, quick thoughts. I love this movie. It's great. I hadn't seen it until within the past year, honestly, but loved it then, and I still do. This is a really, really good movie, in my opinion. Ed Norton gives – I mean, they all give great performances, but when Ed Norton gets to be on screen, he's phenomenal, and he steals the show for sure. Richard Gere is great as well, too. But Ed Norton, fantastic. I really have no qualms about it. I think it's a really enjoyable watch each and every time. Brian, you want to go next?
Yeah, I thought I'd exhausted the 90s crime movie bucket, but somehow this one fell through the cracks, or else I'd seen it and don't remember it. I don't know. But or maybe I got it mixed up with Primal Fear video game, which is awesome, by the way, back in the day. Mortal Kombat with dinosaurs. You remember that shit? Fucking awesome. Anyway, but in the 90s, there were so many of these thriller crime dramas where everybody tried to hit that usual suspects and have that Kaiser Soze twist his dick in it. Seven, The Bone Collector, A Time to Kill, Copycat, Silence of the Lambs, of course. Just so many of them, and they're all so damn good, including this one. But this one just doesn't really get the respect that those do for some reason, and it probably has a little less rewatchability appeal, I guess, though, than those, I'd say. But first time watching, this one's right up there with any of them, in my opinion. Masterclass by everyone involved. Plus, we pair seasoned Richard Gere with, at this point, totally unknown Edward Norton in his debut. Too bad that guy really wouldn't pan out, right? I mean, if he'd only gotten that movie Seven, maybe that would have changed his career. I don't know. Anita Russell, great fucking pick.
First of all, Edward Norton would have made Seven even better. That would have made it a perfect 10 to me when we reviewed it. I gave it like a 9.25 or something like that, but it would have been a 10. But yeah, you mentioned film debut of one of my favorite actors. I mean, he is legitimately a top 5 favorite actor of mine, Edward Norton. The cast is phenomenal. The acting is phenomenal. You mentioned how many of these movies there were in the era, but also just think about how many movies with the word fear were in the era. So this movie debuted in theaters 9 days before the movie Fear did. So yep, a lot of theaters had this movie and Fear playing at the same time. That had to be confusing. I wonder how many people went to the wrong movie like by mistake. But because I remember it's in a movie. I don't remember which one, but she said that she meant to watch 28 Weeks and she ended up watching 28 Weeks Later. It was like really confused by that. So yeah, I wonder how many people did that. This movie is great to me. I do have some nitpicks in my score that we'll go over, but I saw this movie a long time ago, hadn't watched it in probably a decade. So thank you, Anita, for forcing me to watch this masterpiece again. Yeah, I'm excited to review it.
Same. Any more opening thoughts for you to jump into the scene by scene?
Oh, I meant to also say when we found out that she picked Primal Fear, in my mind, I went to Cape Fear. I thought that's what it was. And so that's just another movie from the 90s that has the word fear in it. But that's another good movie that I plan to pick eventually. But yeah, that's a good one.
All right, guys. The film starts with Martin dropping a fire line. If you want justice, go to a whorehouse. If you want to get fucked, go to court. He continues getting ready with some help and heads out as title card and opening credits roll. We hear a choir singing and see the Chicago nightlife. Martin walks in casually late and spots Janet at the table. Round of applause and photo session with the Archbishop. Martin follows Janet to the bar and asks about her quitting smoking and says she's beautiful. He flirts with her more and she turns around, turning down his invite to another bar. She walks away not happy with their relationship. Martin meets with Yancey and Shaughnessy to make a settlement. Martin leaves to meet with his client Pinero to tell him the plea. The Archbishop finishes up in the shower and gets dressed until he has his hand cut in half. The mailman sees the window shatter and it cuts to Martin, who drives to the bar where Pinero is playing pool. $1.5 million, take it or leave it, he tells Pinero, who agrees to the deal. They also want him to leave the state, disappear. Pinero tells him of deals. Other cops try to pitch to him, but he turns them down. Pinero tells Martin he'll pay the money, but he can't leave. This is his home. We see a ton of police and news broadcasters outside the Archbishop's house, protecting the crime scene. Detectives see the carnage inside. We now see one of the choir boys running away full speed, covered in blood, being chased by officers. Detectives record what condition the body is in, and the captain is told about the choir boy being chased. Martin is chatting at the bar about the struggles of being a defense attorney and why he left the state attorney's office. Martin watches the news and sees the man arrested, Aaron Stampler, and leaves the bar. All right, Bryce, opening set of scenes, what'd you think?
Man, you said it, dude. That opening line, if you want justice, go to a horror house. If you want to get fucked, go to court. What a great fucking opening line. I don't know if that's in the original William Dale novel, but it does just such a good job of not only introducing Marty, but you know that this is going to be a different film because it's tackling and addressing issues and questions that we've all asked, like how can lawyers defend pieces of shit, you know, that they believe are guilty? And Vale is one of those characters where, I mean, yeah, you get a character arc with him where his own beliefs do bite him in the butt a little bit at the end, but you do see where this personal rule of his to not care if someone is guilty and to be honest, has played out so well for him throughout his entire career. It doesn't matter, you know, that he believes defending clients are their basic human right, like even if it means representing the guilty or creating his own version of that truth. And again, I think part of his character arc, though, is learning that in the end that it does matter somewhat because, I mean, I don't think he'd ever been put in that position before, like before this or allowed himself to be deceived like he is, spoiler alert. But anyway, very good, deep themes, I think, like that throughout this movie. And can I say it's weird to hear Laura Linney calling someone else Marty other than in Ozark? Because after 4 seasons of that, it's hard to separate her from the character of Wendy, who, by the way, I hated. But anyway, like now you're having the main guy be Marty again. It really threw me for a loop. But like I mentioned, last thing, I know that's based on that William Dale novel, but there's so many times that we've seen again and again, like how books are so much more in depth, so many more intertwining plot lines like this with the Joe Spano case and how it will eventually all come back. just bravo to Steve Shagan and Ann Biderman for writing a screenplay that was, it was able to capture that kind of stuff that maybe wasn't 100% needed for a movie, but it made this, I think, so much better and deeper with those layers.
That's funny that you said that about Laura Linney and Marty and Ozark, because I had that in here in my notes as well. Anyway, decent open. It's a good open with Richard Gere setting the basis for his character and his role as an attorney. It's just good establishing stuff there. Also, shout out to Mara Tierney, a.k.a. Doris from The Iron Claw. Great movie. And Audrey from Liar Liar. Got to be honest with you. This era, Mara Tierney, I had such a crush on her when I was young, when she was younger and I was younger. Like, I don't know. Anyway, good job establishing the layers with Martin and Janet without lingering too much. And, of course, in addition to being Wendy Bird, we also recognize her on this show as, you know, from The Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's a great actress there. But I like how they didn't linger on it. Like, they didn't, we didn't need this long backstory. We see that they have a past and we move on. So good stuff there. great effects on the hand being severed. It looked brutal. The blood looked good. We didn't see too much of it, wasn't overexposed. So I thought that was really well done. We get to see Pinheiro. I love the casting there. Always great to see Manny from my favorite movie, Scarface, or some others may know him as Don Eladio from Breaking Bad. Shout out to Stephen Bauer. This movie's got a great cast from top to bottom. I got to say, though, running from the cops while you're covered in blood, not the best way to look innocent. I get it, but maybe don't do that. This is a very solid open, though, that sets up multiple moving parts. I'm all in.
All right, Martin calls Molly and has her call and find out where Aaron was taken. A lot of lawyers are going to want this case. The press hound dogs him as he walks into the prison. He asks to see Aaron alone and enters his cell. He offers his services pro bono, and Aaron stutters his way into showing his gratefulness. Martin begins asking him basic questions on his life and then asks how he knows the Archbishop. He took Aaron to the Savior House and worked as an altar boy. He let Aaron stay past his 19th birthday and asked if there was anything he had against the Archbishop. He tells Martin there was a third person, and Martin's intrigued. He tells his story and then says he blacked out. I have spells. I lose time. I can't remember nothing. He explains why he ran away from the police, and Martin says he doesn't care. He's his mother, father, priest, and not to talk to anyone but him. Martin watches the news, and it's all about him and the case. Martin makes it to the office and tells Naomi and Goodman the story of Aaron. Goodman says it's all bullshit. And shout out to Goodman. We just saw him in The Mist. Martin tells them he wants all the information possible on this guy. He tells Naomi he needs a psychiatrist and a doctor who specializes in amnesia. Yancey and Shaughnessy give Janet the prosecution job, and she's told they want the death penalty. She's surprised that Aaron has a lawyer already. This should be a slam dunk case. Martin meets with Janet, and she asks if he wants to see some pictures. He looks at the crime scene photos, and the two argue over one needing publicity and nice cars. She leaves the room saying she sleeps well at night, and he's the one with the score to settle. Martin checks out the crime scene, and we see him driving to the prison. All right, Brian, it's the next set of scenes. What'd you think?
Something else I wanted to say, with actors like this, you definitely don't want a soundtrack that doesn't take away or overwhelm the movie. I mean, you want to focus on the performances, which makes this James Newton Howard score really good, because it does just enough, I think, to help with the background, but it doesn't take away anything either, which is kind of the opposite of the review that we just did with Maximum Overdrive soundtrack, where that thing made the movie for them. But Howard has done Pretty Woman, I think, up to this point, and I believe The Fugitive was out before this movie. But we brought him up when we did I Am Legend, Signs, The Split reviews, all at don'tgoother.com. He also worked some on The Sixth Sense, so, I mean, this guy's no stranger to this podcast. Man, we finally get Norton and Gere's first scenes together here. In the behind-the-scenes director, Gregory Hoblit, whose directorial debut, by the way, fucking what a debut, right? Getting Gere and Norton, Jesus Christ. But anyway, Hoblit said that it was Norton's idea to stutter as Aaron, and it was nowhere in the original book or the script. So, I mean, who are we? Just one in a billion people to say Norton's fantastic a million times, but I'm sure this performance helped him get that role in Fight Club. I mean, showing he can kill this dual personality shtick. Nico, you've seen Fight Club, right? You like it?
He's not allowed, you like he's not allowed to talk about it.
Fuck. Fucking first rule. Anyway, Lenny and Gere, last thing I'll say, they have really good chemistry. You know, it's probably why we see them again in a few years in Mothman Prophecies. I'm sure we'll actually do that movie eventually as well. I haven't seen that in probably 20 years, so I kind of want to watch that movie now.
I watched it last year. It holds up. I watched it last year.
It does.
Yeah, I like
that. Me and a buddy of mine used to always just call whenever we would talk about a moth or just fucking anywhere, we'd call it, right, Richard Gere. because of the Mothman Prophecies, but I don't remember that movie at all, hardly.
All right, so it's no secret I love Ed Norton, but I got to admit, I didn't really like his accent in this one. The stutter's great, but I don't know, just didn't work for me. He crushed the role, but I don't really like him as a bumpkin. I don't know. That's a nitpick. Good wrinkle that there was, you know, another person in the room. But again, maybe don't run away while you're covered in blood, you idiot. That's not a movie standpoint. That's a character standpoint. I get, you know, being scared and whatnot, but it's a tough look. I mentioned the great cast earlier, and we get the late, great Andre Brower here, RIP. It's our second time covering a movie he's been in the last month or so. You know, that, hell yeah. Good on him. Richard Gere plays such a convincing lawyer. Like, he just seems like a smug asshole in almost every role he's in. And so I think casting him in this movie in this role is perfect. He's great. One criticism that I have, and this is a legit criticism, the crime scene's a little over the top for me. The killer had the element of surprise and was armed against an unarmed elderly priest. Like, I just have a hard time buying that the room would be in this state of carnage. Like, when the windows were busted out, that seemed unlikely and honestly just convenient so that the mailman would see that happen. Because what kind of struggle could there have been? He cut his fucking hand off. I don't know.
He stabbed him like 78 times, didn't he? It was like fucking just waylaying. So, he wasn't like running around getting stabbed. You're right.
Exactly. So why was shit going through the window? Why was furniture flipped over when the cops got there? I don't know. That was just a little bit overboard for me. But it's another solid set of scenes. Just not a lot to take notes on, really.
Yeah, for sure. Martin enters the prison and other prisoners lick their lips as he walks by. Martin enters Aaron's cell and tells him not to speak, and this is how he wants him to look. No smiling. Martin and his people walk into the court and are being asked questions by the media. Judge Show enters and court begins. Martin asks for more time for a psychological examination. Is denied, but he pleads the fifth to everything, even if he's aware of his charges. Goodman goes to Aaron's apartment and checks it out, but he's attacked by someone hiding in the closet, but he gets the upper hand, snatching the man's earring out, and he flees away. Martin throws Aaron the earring, and he says it belonged to another altar boy. Martin asks why Alex was in his room and where they can find him. He now asks about Linda and shows him the picture. Martin accused Aaron of holding back info from him. Martin asks Aaron if he thinks Alex is capable of doing this murder. Aaron is unsure, though. Martin meets with the doctor, and she confirms she will analyze him but not validate the story. The doctor set up the camera with Aaron, and Martin leaves the room. She begins questioning him about blacking out through life. Martin asks Janet if they can talk and pulls her away from her lunch table. The two discuss on the case, and she says it's a shame he didn't go the insanity route. Martin tells her if she loses this case, she takes the fall, not Shaughnessy. She can't believe he thinks Aaron didn't do it and says, see you in court. Back in court, and the two argue in court about pictures, and she mocks him, asking him to sign the magazine as they leave. All right, Brian, so next set of scenes, what'd you think?
Dustin, you mentioned Aaron Roy's dumbass decisions. Like, I agree, and something I don't really understand is Aaron Roy's thinking on this. I mean, like, if this was his plan all along, why wouldn't you reveal the dual personality earlier so that they could make it his defense from the start? Which is a whole nother thing, by the way. Like, I found out that you can actually change your plea mid-trial, but for the sake of this, let's just say you can't. But I don't know, maybe his idea wasn't to get off anyway. I mean, maybe it was just the theatrics of the whole thing that he wanted, but...
He got off. He got off. You saw the tape.
God damn it. Sorry. You know what that just reminded me of? That just reminded me of the Chris Pratt. That show is, you know what I'm talking about?
Parks,
yes,
right?
the blooper where he talks about comebacks and he talks about Kim Kardashian's. Oh, she had come on her back, I think. Anyway, regardless, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as a plan from Aaron Roy if his intention is to get off, which I know that sounded dirtier in a minute, but I don't really know how else to fucking say that. So I'm just going to have to take the gavel on that one. I don't know. You sickos know what I mean. Why would he not tell about the Archbishop using them for the sex videos? Like, that doesn't make any sense why he wouldn't mention that at all anyway, because if he had never found that tape, then it would have just never come out, right? So I don't know. Alfre Woodard as the judge. Man, this girl has been in everything I know, but come on, her best performance, I know you guys will 100% agree with me, something that also came out this year, 1996's Star Trek First Contact, which, by the way, made $146 million at the box office that year. Money Mike, well, I guess Money Mike's not going to get into the budget, so I don't know, but it made more than this movie. But anyway, Woodard is so good in this. just little acting things that make this so believable here, like starting to talk and then looking up and realizing everybody's still standing in the courtroom and telling them to sit down. That to me was just such a little thing, but it was just so realistic to me. Anyway.
That was, first of all, I love that you refer to him as Aaron Roy, like that's his birth name, Aaron Roy. Also, I ain't gonna lie, you threw me off with the Alfred Woodard. Yeah, she is great, and I'm not opposed to Star Trek, unlike Nico, but I don't know. I just didn't see that one coming. But anyway, I thought you were going to say she was great in Annabelle, because she was. But anyway, good shit from Marty when he said the victim is his client and there's two victims and no suspect. I thought that was a great line. Another DGLT alum, like you said, Alfred Woodard. Loaded cast. Just loaded. When Goodman goes into Aaron's apartment, great directing choice to have the camera focus on his hand with the cloth in it. Like, small things like that are great to point out things that, you know, we may miss. It's another example of that is showing Alex's earring before Goodman ripped it out. Subtle, quick, but it's effective. Marty talking to Molly. Holy shit, Frances McDormand is young here. I mean, this movie came out the same year Fargo did, but she looks so different here, like her hair and everything. But I will say, I'll take this time to recommend another one of her movies, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Fantastic movie by my favorite writer-director, Martin McDonagh. He doesn't miss. All he makes is hits, 4 for 4. Anyway, I was going to ask Mike if he was triggered by something, but he's not on the show, so I'll just ask him and he can reply later. Was he triggered when Janet said the stutter was priceless? Like, was he triggered? Love you, brother. But I will say, Brian, you brought up some good points. I mean, there is some flaws, some holes in the logic here as far as decisions and what tactics, you know, Aaron, if he's planning on getting out of this or having this split personality thing come out, maybe introduce it earlier, because it took a lot to get there. Like, what if the doctor didn't keep pressing on, you know, his girlfriend? Exactly. How would he have done it? And why wouldn't he say something about a tape? Because it's kind of convenient that they even found the tape to begin with. So there are some questionable decisions there as far as the writing goes. But still, it's another very good set of scenes, albeit a little slower.
All right, y'all, bear with me. It's the longest set of scene by scene I have. The doctor is asking Aaron about his girlfriend, Linda. He says she's smart and they had a nice time together. She asks if they had sexual relations and if he was sleeping with anyone else or if she was sleeping with anyone else. He freezes up and he's asked if she's came to see him. He says she went away. She don't even know about this. Martin makes it back to his office and is told the carvings on the chest were wrong. It's 832156. She shows Martin all the charities and foundation investments the Archbishop's involved with. Martin sees he's involved with the South River deal and Shaughnessy is an investor in Panero's neighborhood. Did I get that one right, Dustin? Panero's? Martin meets with Panero and he tells him he's buying back this lot so they don't build condos. Martin asks Martinez if he'll testify after hearing of all these investors. Martin meets with Shaughnessy over dinner as Shaughnessy says he's the great negotiator. Shaughnessy asks about his assistant looking through the Archbishop's financial records. Martin asks him how much money he lost, and he's told not to fuck with him, Marty. Martin gets up and tells him pipes are busting again, John, and leaves the restaurant. Janet and Martin make their opening statements as we see Aaron in bed, the news, and him working. Martin is hound dogged by the press again as the two attorneys walk into court. Janet shows the knife, and Martin speaks on the Archbishop's powerful people losing money. Aaron's shoes are brought in as evidence, and the Archbishop's blood was on his shoes. The inspector admits there's no evidence a third person wasn't there. More cross-examination with the doctor. Back to court, and the captain speaks on the carvings on the Archbishop's chest. It led them to a book and passage in the office. He reads the passage that's underlined to the court. He's asked his opinion on the passage. Martin is visibly annoyed and asks Aaron back in his cell if he underlined that book. Aaron says he wasn't the only altar boy using the books. Martin storms out, and he's quite disappointed in his team for not knowing the Hawthorne story. He snaps on Goodman for not doing his job. And then Naomi snaps at him saying the hard evidence points to Aaron doing it as Martin paces around the courthouse. All right, Bryce, next set of scenes, what do you think?
You know, upon the rewatch and hearing about Linda again, like, I actually forgot that they just threw in that little line at the end about Aaron killing her too. Like, I kind of wish that they would have maybe capitalized on that a little bit more, like maybe found her body or something. I mean, Well, man, well, hell, maybe they did. The original cut of this was super crazy long at like over 3 hours. But I know some of those deleted scenes were more like exploring Aaron's small town life with interviews with his teachers and whatnot. But just saying that, you know, this Linda subplot, maybe it could have been a little bit more. I mean, they were just like, hey, Azalea Davis, you're going to film this little nude scene for a video within a video. And thanks for your time. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, the movie was long enough, so maybe it was for the best. I don't know. I love this line with Joey too, where Joey said, you know, he had his first kiss in this house and got her pregnant. And then Marty says, hell of a kiss, Joey. Like, this movie's sneaky funny. Like, there's lots of great lines throughout. Yeah. Also, is this a prequel to Frasier? Like, where Frasier's dad moves after this and changes his name to Martin Crane? I don't know. Maybe Cheers Multiverse. Rest in peace to John Mahoney, though on the reel, he passed away in 2018. Got a heck of a career, including killing it in this role. I've always seen him play a good guy too, so seeing him in this was pretty awesome to see. And is it just me, or did anyone else think that this guy doing the article and following Marty around the entire movie was going to come back into play as like he was going to be part of the murder or something? I don't know. I don't know if he was meant to be, but he was definitely a red herring for me. So great fucking scene too at the end of this between like a very pissed Vale and Goodman and Naomi. Masterclass. I really, really loved all of that by the elevators.
That's a good point as far for the reporter. I didn't think of that. It didn't come that cross, come away that cross for me, but I could definitely see that. To me, it was more of a way to, in the long run, show Marty's, you know, morality. But anyway, I like the added twist that Shaughnessy was an investor in the Archbishop's Foundation and that this project was in Pinero's neighborhood. That's a great way to tie that back in together because honestly,
right,
kind of forget about Pinero at this point.
Lots of layers. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like an onion. Ogres are like onions. I like the conversation with Marty and Shaughnessy at dinner, but when Marty said that he wasn't aiming for eyes with his thumb, what did he mean by that? Where was he trying to stick his thumb? That was crazy. I also like how the opening scenes were presented. Like the opening to the case scenes were presented. We hear them giving their opening statements and we see Marty and Janet getting ready for court before the words catch up with the scene. I thought that was well done. That was fantastic. And as was the cross-examination. I really like that. We get an oh shit moment when we hear about the book from the secret library. Marty didn't have that, which puts him behind the eight ball, kind of adds some tension there. It does seem like they'd be able to pull Aaron's fingerprints from it, though. I mean, Aaron said he never opened the book, but kind of find out, I guess Roy did it. I don't think your fingerprints change when you have split personalities, so... Seems like the cops would have fingerprinted that book. But anyway, another really good set of scenes.
Unless you're in Split, I think everything changed with that motherfucker.
Right?
The doctor questions Aaron again and brings Linda up. Aaron begins to get upset, saying his head hurts. She asks him if he knows what she can do with his camera, and he snaps, saying, how the fuck should I know? She's scared and calls his name Aaron out, and he's calm and meek again. Martin and Goodman begin chasing after Alex, who's begging for change through traffic. They look for Alex amongst a homeless community, and they finally seize him. Martin snaps on him and asks about the Archbishop's murder. He says he was looking for a tape at Aaron's place. It has sex stuff on it. Aaron filmed Alex and Linda, and the Archbishop said they were purging the devil. He says Linda panicked and split. Alex is arrested. Three hots and a cot. Martin goes to the crime scene and looks around. He looks through the VHS tapes and swaps out one, replacing the label. They're watching the tape back at his office and see the sexual acts. Martin visits Aaron, asking the doctor to leave. He asks Aaron if he trusts him and then says he doesn't trust Aaron. He says he's losing the case and says he's a liar and wants all the information. He tells Aaron he knows about the tape and accuses him of killing him. Aaron snaps and asks who Martin is. Martin asks where Aaron is and Roy pushes him into the wall. Aaron couldn't kick his own ass and mocks his stutter. Roy admits it was him who killed the Archbishop, mocking his stutter again. The two shake hands and Roy looks around for a cigarette. Martin asks Roy about Linda. He calls her a tramp, and everyone got a piece of her. Roy smacks him and says he'll break his fucking neck, asking if he's seen the tape. Roy sees the doctor and snaps back to Aaron. Aaron looks around confused, asking for Mr. Vale. All right, Brian's next set of scenes. What'd you think?
Am I the only one that thought of Liar, Liar, where he's like, I'm kicking my own ass. Do you mind? Anyway, obviously, this scene with Aaron changing into Roy for the first time was, you know, great and fantastic. Frances McDormand, I think, does a great job of seeming legitimately frightened but trying not to show it too much and like slowly slip to the door. But I got to ask, like, what's the point though of the camera battery going off? Like, I couldn't decide if Aaron Roy heard it beeping and then decided to switch to Roy. But then it doesn't make any sense if he's legitimately trying to turn it into an insanity defense.
I didn't have that in my notes, so I want to touch on it before I forgot. That's a good point, because it's almost like the battery beeping was meant to be like a trigger, something that sent him over, but he was just playing a part. He wasn't really split. So, yeah, pointless.
It was meant to do something. Like, it felt like it was seemed to mean something, but it never came back into play. And, you know, as we see later, when Marty is watching the playback of this, he does get it on video. So, you know, that wasn't even anything. So, again, I ask, what's the point of the battery going out? I don't know. Anyway, something else. Alex tells them about the tape here in the alley, but how does Marty know which tape to grab when he goes to the Archbishop's house? Like,
yeah,
did you think about that too? Like, what the fuck? Like, because they were all labeled sermons. Like, I caught that on the first watch, honestly, and half expected him to have to like go back and forth like until he finds the one. But wow, got lucky on the first try. By God. Last fun fact here, and I'll shut up. Apparently, Roy shoving Vale was also an ad lib from Norton, which is why you can see genuine shock from Richard Gere, and also why you can see the wall give some when he's pushed up against it. Like, you can see it definitely isn't real brick when that happens. But I get wanting to keep that in the movie despite the goof, because it adds so much realism to the performances for sure. Just amazing job from Norton.
Yeah. So it's really intense when Aaron refused to talk about Linda. Like, it plants a lot of suspicion about that situation. Then he snaps on Molly and didn't remember what they were talking about. Like, that's an eyebrow raiser. That's great. Well, and it's well done. And Norton acted his ass off there. He definitely has blind rage. So that's what it looks like. And then here's something. Imagine being a hobo, minding your fucking business under this bridge with your barrel fire, and three assholes just run you over and don't even apologize. What dicks?
With your barrel fire.
You got your barrel fire there. Just that bitch was blazing. Don't get me wrong. They did a good job on that fire.
With them. Sorry to all of our homeless listeners.
But yeah, I mean, what assholes are they? Like, that was the first thing I popped up. He plowed him. Marty ran, like, he tackled him to the ground. And then just stood up and kept running like nothing happened. Didn't even say sorry about that. Like, asshole. Anyway. I did laugh at how sweaty Marty and Goodman got. They look like they just played all 48 minutes in Game 7 when they just ran for like 3 minutes. Those Hobart fires must have been blazing under that bridge. Like, anybody else not, like, that was an insane amount of perspiration on those guys. Looked like he went double overtime on your old lady, and he's out here just running for 3 minutes. Finding out the Archbishop made them record amateur pornos, that's another good added layer, establishes a hell of a motive. What a sick fuck he was. Aaron's personality split was just absolutely incredible. Again, incredible, amazing performance from Norton. This is a great set of scenes despite the soap opera editing, with Norton staring off as the scene fades. Didn't like that, but this is probably my favorite set of scenes, though.
All right. Martin exits the jail and gets a soda with the doctor. He admits that Aaron did it. Doctor said he didn't do it, saying it's multiple personality disorder. Martin says he can't change plea middle of the trial, and insanity is hard to prove. Doctor says he's a sick kid, not a criminal, and Martin asks for an aspirin. He looks at Aaron sleeping and leaves the jail. He's at the bar now moping and offers Connerman a shot. Martin tells him he does his job, not for the money or fame, but he does like both. He does it because he believes in the notion people are innocent until proven guilty. Sometimes very good people do very bad things. He tells him something illegal he did working with Shaughnessy, and he tells him he'll sue him if he prints any of this, and walks away from the bar. He walks in his office apologizing, and he got their third man. He's clueless how to get Aaron off on murder. Martin snaps on Goodman and says he's going to bring up the abuse. Doorbell buzzes at Janet's apartment, but no one's there. She picks up a package from her doorstep. She calls Martin, asking what he's doing. She demands they meet at the bar. He lies, saying he knows nothing about the tape, and she's furious at him. He asks her what the motive is, and she calls him out on how much they know each other. He lies about the cut on his face. She storms out, furious at him. Janet is at Shaughnessy's office, and he asks her about the tape, and they both know Martin delivered it, and he orders her to destroy the tape as soon as she gets home. All right, Bryce, the next set of scenes, what'd you think?
Now, on the first watch, three of this is all money. But again, on the subsequent rewatches, like, this is where the movie starts to get a little slow to me, which honestly is just the nature of the beast. I mean, it's also what makes it so good the first time. So it's definitely give it a give or take for sure. One thing I thought when Molly tells Marty here, put me on the stand, I was like, bro, he does. And Janet fucking destroys your credibility with the snap of a finger by literally asking your credentials. Fuck out of here, Molly. And, you know, I talk about this being sneaky funny. Goodman is a half of that. Like, dude is hilarious. Like, when he's, you got your third man, your fourth man. Marty stabbed him a billion times. Like, he needs an exorcist. Dude is us. And I think how we would be trying, like, in a case like this, I think we would be the ones fucking around saying shit like that. He's my favorite character in this movie.
Hell yeah.
And just again, like, I know I said it before, but Laura and Richard have such damn good chemistry, especially here at this bar. They do such a good job of playing, you know, sparring partners, but also having that little bit of a past love in their relationship. And everyone knows what I'm talking about, too, because, I mean, a ton of people listening right now have been in this situation with coworkers. Just such a fantastic scene between those two. I loved it.
Yeah, good shit with Marty and Molly talking about Aaron and how he really can't change his plea at this stage. Really well done, despite, like you said, Brian, it may not be the most accurate. I don't know. I don't know the law like that. Tend to be on the other side of it. You know, maybe that was the case in 96. I don't know. Or maybe that's the case in Chicago. But biggest question I have about this whole fucking movie, what the hell kind of bar was Marty drinking at? He had the whole bottle sitting in front of him. Like, he had the bottle. He put $3 on the counter to pay for it. Where they do that at? What the hell is that about? Because
inflation.
I don't know if inflation's like they a bitch. They even made sure to show us that it was dollar bills. It was singles, and he took three of them things out to pay for a whole bottle of liquor. Hell yeah. I like seeing the wheel spin in Marty's head when he was trying to figure out his next move and decided the tape was the best way. And an absolute genius play to have the tape left anonymously on Janet's doorstep. She'd have to introduce it. Like, if she's any kind of lawyer who wants to win the case, she has to. So my man was playing 4D chess. I did think it was interesting to have Goodman do it, though. That can't be the only three people that he knows in the city of Chicago. Like, have someone else do it. So even if she calls Goodman to the stand, he has plausible deniability. I don't know. But more good shit here. We're really ramping up.
All right, back in court, and Janet calls Thomas Goodman to the bench. Martin objects but agrees to let Goodman testify. She asks if he's been to her apartment building. He admits he delivered a videotape to her apartment. Goodman admits he made a copy, and they return the original back to the Archbishop's. Shaughnessy looks furious as he walks into the court. The court is in shock, finding out the Archbishop was the director of the porno tape. Court's in recess to set the tape up. Thanks for the advice, you tell Shaughnessy as she walks out. Martin watches the recordings of Aaron with the doctor until he gets a phone call. Bad news as we see Panero's dead body pulled from the water. Back in court, Martin gives Shaughnessy and Yancey a death stare and calls him to the stand. He questions Shaughnessy now about the fallout with the South River project. Court erupts when he says $60 million. Martin asks about a case in 1985 of a sexual assault victim with the Archbishop. Judge Choate puts the court in recess and has Martin come to her office. Yancey tells Janet to start looking for another job. She says she's striking his testimony and fining him $10,000 for making a mockery of her courtroom. She says he needs to represent his client and not himself. Martin watches more of the recordings of Aaron and pauses it when he snaps. Martin calls a doctor to the stand. Janet asks to approach, and Choate talks to both of them. Choate allows it carefully, and the doctor explains how Aaron could be present and not remember it. Janet objects the doctor's opinion, and she questions the doctor. The doctor steps down, and Martin takes a recess. All right, Bryce, next set of scenes, what'd you think? And I don't know why Judge's name is kicking my ass right now. Go ahead.
And that's funny, Dustin, that you mentioned you didn't – the last set of scenes, you were like, I don't know a lot about the legal system, because I wrote right here in this set of scenes that, look, I don't know a lot about the legal system, but for Janet to call Goodman to the stand here, like, doesn't the defense have to know in advance? Like, and I mean, I know he's generally in the courtroom, but what if he wasn't? Like, it kind of goes for the same for Shaughnessy when he's called. Like, it seems reckless, but hey, I'm not an attorney. And Janet looking at Shaughnessy on the way out to recess and saying, thanks for the advice. That was badass. That was like, hey, fuck Shaughnessy.
Yep.
There was a little bit of a goof here, though, around the hour and 35 minutes when Joey's dead body was being pulled out of the water. It must have really been cold because, I mean, you can definitely see Stephen Bauer, who plays him, breathing in his cold breath. And I know, Dustin, you mentioned Bauer being in Nico's favorite film, Scarface, as well in Breaking Bad, but also Carlos in Traffic, another great film.
Yeah.
But funny goof there. I don't know how editing doesn't catch that one. But this set of scenes picks everything really back up, you know, when the court hearings start really playing out with Shaughnessy on the stand. And, you know, why would the judge strike his testimony from the record when he was just proven to at least shed some doubt on what all was going on and showing that it was bigger than this? But I really didn't understand that because he was the DA, it was corrupt. I don't know. Anyway, great group of scenes regardless.
Yeah, it's a brilliant move by Janet to call Goodman to the stand. But like you said, maybe don't have him go to court that day. I don't know. Maybe they could have subpoenaed him to come testify, but if he's not there, he could have had more time to prep for it, and they would have known that he's being called. Anyway, more good
but shit. But isn't it a law, though? Like, don't you have to let either the prosecution or the defense know about people you're calling to the stand beforehand? Or can you just randomly do this?
I think you can randomly do it. You can't introduce evidence with that. Like, if you introduce new evidence, then they get a chance to review it. But you can call surprise witnesses, I believe. I don't know. Like I said, I'm usually on the other side. good shit from Brower, when he got to the stand. And just like you said, Brian, boss move from Janet to basically give Shaughnessy the bird on her way out of the courtroom. Hell yeah, I love that line. Pinheiro being fished out of the water is another eyebrow raiser. Like, it really makes you wonder how this all ties in. Like, how deep is this? The courtroom gasp. The courtroom fucking gasp. Huge issue with that. Shaughnessy says $60 million, and they just like, that's so unnecessary, man. The people have no idea, you know, what typical investments are like. They have no reason to react that way. $60 million is a lot of money, but investments fail every day. And at this point, it's irrelevant to the case. So just having them gasp like that when they found out that they lost $60 million, that was a weird choice to me. Maybe I'm harping on it too much. But Vail did a great job painting his narrative. I don't think Marty went overboard to the point the judge would have reacted that way and dished out that kind of punishment, though. Like, hold him in contempt. Like, he didn't do anything egregious. But it's a great job by Marty to get all the answers that he's looking for from Molly without crossing the judge. Like, he's like, hey, I didn't ask her that. She said it. So I thought that was really good acting and good writing. And this is another pretty good set of scenes.
And yeah, you're right about the crowd and the court and everybody gasping. You could have just, like, if you wanted to bring attention to that, you could have just had him maybe whispering or something and had, you know, the judge be like, all right, but order, whatever. But
like that's the kind of reaction you expect. That's the kind of reaction you expect from a courtroom peanut gallery if they're like, and here's the murder weapon.
Right. Right.
$60 million failed investment that had nothing to do with the case. I don't know.
Good point.
All right. Completely off topic, but is it just me? Every time I hear Marty, I'm thinking of Woody Harrelson from doing True Detective.
Ozark.
Oh, just me. Okay. Anywho, back to the scene by scene. Martin questions Aaron now on the stand, asking his relationship with the Archbishop. He saved my life. He was the only person who gave me a chance. He asks about seeing the tape and his feelings. He asks Aaron if he knows someone named Roy. Janet questions Aaron now. Aaron gets uncomfortable from the tough questions, rubbing his head and face. Janet says she'd murder him like Aaron did, and she steps away. Roy takes over, asking where the hell she's going, and jumps the bench and chokes her. All hell breaks loose, and he threatens to break her neck. They get Roy off of her and handcuff him. Martin checks on her as Aaron is escorted out. Janet tries to light up a cigarette, but Judge stops her and pours some drinks. Schultz says she will allow a bench trial and will try him for insanity. She walks out, refusing to refund Martin's contempt fee, and Janet lights up her cigarette. He asks her if she's okay, and she says all the reasons she's not okay. She says he used her. He says he's arrogant. That's why he knows what's best for her, and hugs her. He asks if she wants to dance. She embraces him and says no. He lets her go to see his client, and they share a smile as he leaves the office. All right, Bryce, the next set of scenes, and the next set is the ending. Go ahead.
Soundtrack probably the most prominent at the start of this group of scenes, with Marty deliberating on what to do next, if he could put Aaron on the stand or not. But there's these trumpets from Howard that are just so damn loud in this. It almost sounds like one of those sex scenes in the old Skinamax shows back in the day. Mike told me about those. Otherwise, I would never know about that. Mm. Right, Mike? Say nothing if that's true. Yeah, okay.
It must be true. Bordellos.
You know something else I was hoping would come back into play was the being right and left-handed thing. Like, they touched on it, and I thought, okay, well, maybe that'll come back into play more with, like, Roy versus Aaron, and you know how like you split personalities can be right-handed versus left-handed, but it never did. Just a thought I had. The rest of this is just masterclass acting between Lenny and Norton. You know, Gear had his sparring match with Norton already, and Lenny gets her chance here and does not disappoint. Just absolutely fantastic.
Brian, you really took me back talking about those Skinamax flicks. I had to look it up. There was one called Beverly Hills Bordello that when I was like a senior in high school or right after high school, my friends and I would watch it every single weekend on Showtime. Anyway, Marty's
Red Shoe Diaries action.
Marty's examination of Aaron was great. Him goading Aaron into turning into Roy was a masterclass. Like I like when he covered the mic and so quit being a pussy or whatever he said. That was great. And Norton gave a hell of a performance here too. The cuts to his hands, that was a great directive choice because it really convinced us, the viewer, that this guy really does have split personality disorder and he's about to snap. So I thought that was a great job to show his nervousness and his anxiety. When he snapped, woo, buddy, that was intense. He jumped across that stand. It reminded me of, I'm sure you guys remember, it was from a couple months ago this year when the guy was found guilty or something. He jumped the bench and attacked the judge. That shit was crazy.
Right.
Hell of a day Marty had, man. He won the case and got his girl. Goat. How you piss her off that much? She lost her job. And she, when you leave, you're hugging up on her and she smiles at you on the way out the door. I mean, that guy's got riz like you wouldn't believe. But just phenomenal stuff here. Let's go home. I'm ready for the finish.
Oh, yeah. This ending is great. Martin enters Aaron's jail cell asking for a minute alone. He asks if he's okay and asks if he remembers what happens. He tells Aaron they stopped the trial and are sending him to a hospital to get the help he needs. Aaron is in shock and speechless. He tells Martin he knew he'd be okay the second Martin walked into his cell. Martin goes to leave and Aaron asks when he'll see him again and they hug. Thank you, Aaron says, and he tells Martin to tell Miss Venable I'm sorry and I hope her neck is okay. He says yeah and walks away, then realizes what just happened. He calls him out on his blackouts. Aaron claps now, smiling, saying good for you, Marty. He laughs. It doesn't matter who you hear it from, Aaron or Roy. It's the same story. He now reveals he killed Linda. That cunt got what she deserved. Cutting up the Archbishop was a work of art. Martin compliments him, saying he's good. There never was an Aaron, counselor. Martin walks out in shock as Roy keeps talking. Martin sneaks out the back door of the courtroom so he can avoid all the press, not wanting the fame and attention this time. All right, Brian, what'd you think of that ending?
Great twist, obviously. The old dick twist. But, you know, Roy's slow clap at the end was also ad-libbed by Norton. Fantastic. And, you know, I had this in Fun Facts, but I'll put it here because I don't really have a lot of notes on this set of scenes. But both Will Wheaton and DiCaprio both turned down this role of Roy Aaron. Wow. I mean, we know DiCaprio could have pulled it off. Like, we know that. But oh, yeah. This movie would have bombed. This movie would have bombed with Will Wheaton in it. Like, I mean, yeah, he was good in Stand By Me, but look how he was through the years in Star Trek. You guys know. I'm sure you've seen every episode he was in. Him turning down the role against the advice of his manager was a godsend. Deborah Aquila and Jane Shannon Smith were both responsible for casting. Thank God they went back to the drawing board and had these auditions, which I think if I read Norton, or I read somewhere that Norton had to audition like 6 or 8 times or some crazy number like that, because I don't know if anyone else here is familiar with Wheaton's work, but this would have been terrible. I'm sorry. No way Wheaton pulls this off. And how different would Norton's career have looked? Crazy to think about that. Great ending, though.
Yeah, I have one sentence. Not much to take notes on here, but it's a really cool moment when Marty gave Aaron the good news, but we're not done yet. Like, that final twist was a hell of a final twist. Like, he remembered? Wait, what do you mean you remember? Like, that shit was great. Like, even the reveal was well done. So 10 out of 10 on the ending. That was phenomenal.
All right, guys, into our social media comments and questions. I'll do Instagram where we have almost nothing, but we do have one comment. Missy Hutchinson Wall, former blood donor herself, commented, I really like this film. As you should, Missy. This is a great one. Brian, Dustin, y'all want to do Facebook and X?
Well, I can do X because we don't have any. So go ahead, Brian.
All right. On Facebook, we did have a few. Dana Maxie Tucker said, I have a question. Did you know? Did you figure it out?
I didn't.
In hindsight, I can say, yeah, I knew, but that'd be lying. Like, first time I saw this movie, I was much younger and didn't watch as many movies, so absolutely not. If I watched it for the first time today, I would at least have suspicion, but I probably wouldn't have known.
Yeah, and after seeing so many movies like we talked about, like Seven and the Kaiser Soze, Is It Usual Suspects, like all of those type of movies that did this now, and this was my first time watching it, and I did at least have, like, I knew something was going to happen. I couldn't remember what it was, if I'd seen it, or maybe it was just in the zeitgeist, but yeah, I did to an extent. Jennifer Tyree, one of my all-time favorite movies. That twist is killer. No pun intended. Love this movie from Teresa Morrow Howell. Cheyenne Turner. Love this movie. Well, that's a little bit different. Dana Maxey Tucker. Again, Edward Norton was brilliant in this movie. Can't wait to listen. And Kevin Potthoff. Great movie. Can't wait.
Whoa. Kevin with some positivity. Hell yeah, brother.
Very rarely hear that. We can do fun facts first. I only got a couple. Brian, sorry if these have been said. A lot of words have been said. I had like 2,700 in mind, so a little tired. But anyhow, I only got two of them. Edward Norton was among 2,100 actors who auditioned for the role of Aaron Stampler. Don't know if that's been said, but that's pretty impressive. And the other one I got is Pedro Pascal stated in a 2014 interview that his first ever audition was for the role of Aaron Stampler. Shout out to Pedro. I haven't seen shit he's been in.
I was about to say, he's in a bunch of Star Wars movies. I know that fucker. I ain't seen those.
he's in a lot of other stuff here recently, especially. He's really catching steam. Great actor. Okay, gotcha. So I'm going to expand on what Nico said there. 2,100 actors audition. We've already said Leo DiCaprio turned it down. That was because he was exhausted from shooting What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yep.
Come on. He got soft hands, brother. He never worked a day in his life. You mentioned Pedro Pascal. Among the others, though, James Marsden, great actor. James Vanderbeek, great actor. Edward Furlong. And Danny Masterson, whatever happened to that piece of shit?
Wow.
But the most notable one that wanted this movie desperately, Matt Damon. So he missed out on a role a couple years before this. Wanted this role desperately. Didn't get it. When he didn't get it, he went on to write a little movie with his buddy Ben Affleck called Good Will Hunting. So in a roundabout way, we have Primal Fear to thank for giving us one of the best movies ever made, Good Will Hunting. That's incredible. Brian, you mentioned the original cut was over 3 hours long. It was actually 3 hours and 15 minutes. Thank God they shaved an hour and 5 minutes off of it, because this movie was long. I ain't gonna lie. Last thing I have, Maura Tierney. She was in The Iron Claw with Maxwell Jacob Freeman, who was also an executive producer on the movie. And MJF had a feud with Cody Rhodes in AEW. Cody Rhodes had a faction at one time called the Nightmare Family, which included Diamond Dallas Page, who was in Ready to Rumble with David Arquette. And DDP also teamed with Arquette in WCW in 2000 and helped him win the WCW World Heavyweight Championship on April 27th episode of WCW Thunder. Suck it.
Damn. Woo.
Hell yeah.
Throwback.
Man, I'm fired up now. Hell yeah, brother.
And then Mike sent the budget, so I'll go ahead and say it. And he also sent a score, so I'll get to that in a second. The budget was $30 million. The gross was $100 million. And he put in parentheses, Brian's monthly salary. Wowzers.
Slander.
It's a lot of money.
That's a lie. It's a lie.
Good on you, Brian.
All right, let's jump into our favorite kill, least favorite kill, and the rating. I'll go first, then you can read Mike's if you want to, Dustin, or however you want to do it. Favorite kill, I just went with Archbishop. Worst kill, Panero. Kind of, this movie's not really about the kills. It's about the twist and all that good stuff. Twist his dick. Anywho, great movie. Anita Russell, really appreciate your donation. It means a lot to us. I mean, we've been doing this show almost 5 years now, and it still kind of blows my mind that fans are so passionate about our show, such big fans that they pay for us to review movies. It means a lot. And you picked a great one, Anita. I really like this movie. I really have no qualms about it, except that I'm not going to be in the mood to watch Primal Fear too often, but great movie, great twist. I love it. 9.5 for me.
All right. So I'll read Mike's and then I'll give mine. So Mike said, Primal Fear is so damn good. One of the better crime dramas that I've seen. Gear is great here, and this early stuff from Norton is maybe some of his best shit. Great cast all around. Love the inclusion of this fake multiple personality disorder stuff. Norton nails it. I love how it really looks like you're going to get a happy ending, and then they grab you by the dick and twist. First time I watched, I fell for the nice guy bullshit. a little long, but I never really feel the runtime. Great movie, and I'm glad I got to rewatch it. 9 out of 10. So I'll give mine. My favorite kill was the Archbishop, because we at least got to see his hand get cut off. I did his favorite kill and least favorite kill. Least favorite kill is Pinheiro. Man, he didn't deserve to die again. Tony already killed him. As far as the rating, final thoughts. Peter Travers from the Rolling Stone, a well-respected movie critic, said this: you'd get more of a jolt from Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote, and more intellectual stimulation from a cozy game of Clue. Boy, did he miss the mark.
Nah, fuck that guy.
That guy gets paid to review movies and has done it for years. Like, he's well-respected. That's a well-known name. Bullshit. He's wrong. This movie is incredible. The acting alone is incredible. And then, you know, the story is a good story. I did have some nitpicks here and there that I mentioned, but all in all, I love it. And I'm not in a hurry to rewatch it, but I won't shy away from a rewatch. I gave it a 9.
That's crazy. Short and sweet, great movie, great cast. It only really gets slow on certain scenes in the middle upon rewatches to me. I almost gave this a 10, but while a great movie, I just don't have it at that 7, the movie, or Silence of the Lambs level. And I also gave this one a 9.
All right. That gives us a composite score of 9.125. IMDb is at 7.7. And it's at 77% on Rotten Tomatoes. Interesting.
Unreal.
That's crazy.
Unreal.
Yeah. Well, they're wrong.
We gotta go vote, boys. All right. Anywho, shout out to Anita. We really appreciate you again. Speaking of blood donors, let's go ahead and shout them out, and then we'll get out of here. Anita Russell, Primal Fear, great choice. Really appreciate you, Anita. Camper Level Reoccurring, Nina, Michelle Mirza, the Horror Movie Crew Podcast, Alex Seligson, and Michael Evans. Camp Council Reoccurring, Edwin Hernandez Gunn, Joe Swinford, Shan, Adrian Aiello, Brian Samick, Andrew Ferguson, Matt Strickland, Brooke Maley, Thorne David Phillips, Heather Superdoc, Jennifer Davis from the Too Close to Home Pod. If you like true crime, check them out. Dana Tucker and Cole McAlexander. We really appreciate y'all's donations. It means a lot to us. It does take a big burden off us. We can't stress that enough. Guys, final thoughts on Primal Fear before we get out of here? Great pick.
Great movie.
Great pick.
Good movie.
Brian, why don't you announce your pick for our free month next week?
I'm continuing with the franchise that we talked about, I think, over the last few episodes on how we wanted to knock out some of these. I went with Final Destination 3, the next one in the sequence. I think we have done 1, 2, and 5. So
yep.
I went with Final Destination 3. I like it.
You in a hurry to pick 4?
Yeah, yeah. No, not really.
Something about that movie makes me want to go ride a roller coaster. I don't know.
I want to get
wait. Which one? Wait, which one's the car NASCAR one or whatever?
4. Is that 4? The shitty one.
Yeah, the shitty one.
Woof.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We appreciate y'all listening. Speaking of Final Destination, I'm gonna go hop in the tanning bed now. Y'all have a good one.
Just want to remind everybody.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.